Hey everyone, welcome to another Game of Thrones Tower Bubble Breakdown. As always, I am Julian Musha. I'm joined by Daniel D'Souza.
Yo.
And we are here to talk about Season 1, Episode 8, the title which is...
The Pointy End.
Yes, okay, because last time, I went and listened to our Episode 7, our Season 1 Episode 7, and I went to you for the name, and you were like, you totally whiffed on it for like a good couple seconds. Yeah.
Well, that was months ago. This is real time, finally. This is not a pre-recorded episode.
It's not necessarily real time, but yeah, it's more real time.
It's current.
Yeah. Because this won't post until next week.
We're older, we're wiser, learned some lessons.
I'm a full 6 months older than I was and 6 months poorer too. We actually got some nice emails from people saying, you know, that they're glad we're back and that we're too hard on ourselves. And thank you, but also no, we're not hard enough on ourselves. We're pieces of shit. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. But no, we really do appreciate that feedback. So thank you for being happy that we're back, because I felt like we'd lost literally every listener. I just assumed that you guys all have left, which would have been understandable. But anyway, we're back. If you are new to the show, which is again very strange, you'd be jumping on to this episode. But if you are, we're about to break down Season 1, Episode 8 of Game of Thrones in a retrospective fashion. So we're going to spoil everything up through Season 7, because that's where the show left us. And kind of talk about this first season in context with the rest of them. Follow us on Twitter, at TowerBabbleCast, facebook.com/TowerBabbleCast, and head over to TowerBabble.ca to find everything that we do. Including the awesome interview I did with Pablo Hidalgo, or me and Dan did with Pablo Hidalgo.
What the fuck?
That I did, Daniel. It was my interview. I did the legwork getting him, though.
Literally walking over and getting him. Yes, the legwork.
Well, and talking to him and asking for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not trying to take credit for anything. but I've plugged that enough times on the show now in the last 2 weeks. So if you haven't listened to that by now, shame on you. All right. So let's jump into this week's episode. It for everyone else, it's going to feel like, oh man, it was just like just last week we were talking about episode 7 and this week we're talking about episode 8. It's been a while since we talked about Game of Thrones. So if we retread something, I apologize. I feel like we won't though. I feel like we're pretty good.
I'm on top
job.
Of it.
Yeah. All right. So this episode starts actually, before it even gets into like the first scene, we should mention this was written by George R. R. Martin. That's important to
He does
know.
One episode a season generally, and this was...
At that time, yeah. He hasn't written one in a while.
The latest season, I don't think he did. Maybe the last two.
Anyway, it's written by George R. R. Martin, and I think... Well, we'll call out some George R. R. Martinisms throughout the episodes, because there's definitely a few that are a lot of fun. So the actual episode opens with... like picks up basically right after the events of... the episode 7 with Ned and his men being captured and killed. We pick up and all of Ned's men are just being brutally slaughtered.
Yep.
Like unnecessarily brutal, I'd say, in certain moments. Like there's like one person is like just like casually mentioning something and they're like, oh yeah, whatever. And then like it cuts to like the other way and there's like people charging at them with swords and then they just get cut down.
A spear through the gut. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a bit rough, but it is pretty cool because it like starts in media res. It's very fun, very like energetic. Mm-hmm. And we see Arya and Syrio. Arya.
Yeah. That's the portmanteau.
Yeah, Syrio Forel. And they are kind of doing their sword dancing thing.
Water dancing.
Yeah. And all of the Lannister men come in on them. And then what happens?
Well, actually, prior to that, we had Sansa and Septa Mordain walking. Right. It's just like a little nod to these characters, the Septa and Syrio, that make the noble sacrifice to save
these
Septa
kids. Mordain gets murdered there, presumably.
Presumably. Yeah. It happens off screen, but we all know that's exactly what happened. so I like to point that kind of stuff out. These characters knowingly sacrificing themselves for the children. It's a nice touch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right. Then it goes to Arya and Syrio.
I forgot about that Sansa scene, but only because it's like very short and it's more of whiny Sansa that we don't really like. She's actually not as bad this episode, but in that particular,
that's a good point. And it like there are moments earlier in the season that Sansa is downright petulant towards the Septa, and then it just demonstrates the sort of maturity and the nobility of that character to still sacrifice herself, even though the kid was just a punk. She's a punk kid, but she knows better, right? Arya and Syrio again. This is a point that I think I'm harping on a lot, if I remember correctly, in the first season, and just in general. It's sort of a microcosm that is demonstrating the loss of innocence, especially for Arya's character. The small microcosm that I'm mentioning is you know, he says he's going right, but he goes left.
Yeah.
And she's not fair.
She's like, what are you talking about?
That's an injustice, right? Yeah. Yeah. But that's not how the world works. It's not so cut and dry. And that becomes Arya's arc. That's a major theme of the books and the show in general, but that becomes a huge part of Arya's arc specifically, to the point that where we are in episode 7, she trusts no one but herself.
Yeah.
Right?
Including her own sister, which is a fair based on the last time she saw her. Yeah. So Syrio kind of questions like, wait a minute, you know, if Ned called for her, why is he sending Lannister men? And he's... Because Syrio, like, Arya's like, oh, yeah, I'll go.
Because she's a kid. She's still innocent. Yeah, sure, she hasn't lost her innocence yet. Yeah.
And he's like, no. Puts his arm out. Like, no, you're not going anywhere. He sends her away and then, like, kicks ass with a wooden sword for a bit. We don't see him die on screen. This is a long-held theory that he's alive still. That the screams you hear are actually him murdering all the Lannister men. Do we know? Like the guy who comes and like fights him, like the commander there. Do we see him again? Do we know?
Oh yeah. He's one of the Kingsguard. That's Sir Meron Trant. You see him a bunch.
Okay. Yeah. Right. It's hard to tell. He beats the crap out of Sansa when they're wearing their armor.
Yeah. But he's the only one that's other than Jaime and Ser Barristan that is really given a character in the show.
Yeah.
The rest of them are very full fledged characters in the books, but he becomes sort of an amalgam of them. So like there are some that were more cruel than others. Blah blah blah. He just becomes all of those guys. The characters, especially Syrio, they should be acutely aware that, you know, Jaime attacked Ned in the streets.
Yeah.
The Lannisters and the Starks are at each other's throats. There's no reason that Lannister men would be coming for Arya.
Yeah.
And he is badass with a wooden sword. The whole time I'm thinking, like, why don't you just grab one of their swords?
Yeah. 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 Because, you know? Like, he knocks them out and then, like, okay, now you... Because then even his sword is broken, like his wooden sword is broken. Yeah. He still doesn't make a move to try to grab another sword.
I guess...
Presumably. We don't see. Maybe he does.
Okay, so... It's a different type of sword. They all use long swords or broad swords. Yeah. He's not like,
yeah, but he's water still
dancing.
Could, probably.
I'm sure he could be effective with it, but water dancing is more akin to fencing than it is to the type of sword fighting we see most often in the show.
Yeah, but okay, to be fair, that wooden sword he's holding is a wooden broadsword.
No, it's thin. It's very thin.
No. Go back and watch it.
It's definitely not a saber. It's not an épée, but it's not a broadsword either. That's what they use in fencing. Is it called an épée? Francais.
When we were at Gamescom, we were never at Gamescom. When we were at FanQuest, they were doing a like Jedi like lightsaber fights there. Mm-hmm. It was essentially just like fencing.
Yeah.
They were wearing the same like fencing gear. It was more like what's the Japanese one? Kaibo or you know what I'm talking about?
Kento?
Though, right? Kento. No. Yeah, I
think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Which is wooden swords, yeah.
Yeah. So that was pretty cool. But they looked like lightsabers, so that's dope. I didn't get to see any of it. I just saw them packing up their stuff. But
even that was cool.
Yeah, even that was pretty cool.
Okay, in terms of Syrio being alive.
There's no way. Because if Meryn Trant's alive, he wouldn't have left Syrio to like just walk away.
That's not necessarily true.
Because he's a coward? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's proven later on. This is something that I noticed on my most recent watch through. I've watched this show a million times, but
yeah.
We just watched it now in preparation for the episode.
For the record, I'm waiting to rewatch the entire thing. I'm waiting to meet someone who hasn't watched it and is willing to sit down and rewatch the whole thing with me. It's like a
few and far between, man.
I know it's hard to find. Actually, you know what? No. I take that back. It's not true. I meet more and more people all the time who are like, "No, I've never seen any of it."
In my personal experience, the type of person that hasn't seen it, it's not about types of people, but like.
That's how I judge people.
A lot of people who haven't seen it, because it's such a cultural phenomenon, they're at least aware of it, and it's now become part of your identity. Be like, well, I'm not one of those people. Like,
I'm not one of those, oh, I don't watch Game of Thrones. No, but it's too cool for that.
You're this far gone, you're invested, so you're just going to not watch it.
Well, it's tough. It's like how many seasons into a thing you're like, yeah, just jump on. It's like you're six years into it. Like, no. And it's like it's
I don't know.
It's a big ask to ask people to watch 60 hours of television to catch up to, or 70, or, you know, 67.
I mean, it's not a, it's know, not like, a big ask when it's great TV. It's a big ask if there's like
no.
Terrible seasons.
It could be the best television. But telling someone to watch that many hours of television in a short amount of time to catch up for the last season is a big
ask. So don't frame it that way. But like, it's the same as if I tell someone to watch Breaking Bad, you're going to enjoy every minute of Breaking Bad.
No, I watched the first season and then I fell off in season two.
Well, okay,
that's not the only person I've talked to who's done
that. That's not the point. Yeah. The point is, you'll enjoy it while you're watching it for the most part.
Right. But you can understand the daunting. Like,
yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I don't watch Doctor Who. I know it'll,
yeah, but there's so many places
you
could jump on. I've never watched any Doctor Who, but I know that if I want to, there's a whole bunch of different jump on points.
I know, but the way that my mind works, if I wanted to watch Doctor Who,
you're starting in the 30s or whatever?
I would just watch it all. I wouldn't, yeah.
No, it's crazy.
Yeah, I know. That's what I say. It'll ruin my life.
Mm, yeah, that's a bad idea. So don't watch that.
Okay, so is it what I noticed in terms of Ciri being alive, when we cut to Arya, she's about to make a decision whether to go upstairs or downstairs, essentially.
Yeah,
and you hear the screaming and the way maybe
there's a lot of different screams. So
it sounds like it's coming
from one person.
The screaming is coming from the upstairs where the light is. That's
the
real world, and then she goes down the stairs into her secret world, essentially.
She goes to the stables.
Right. No. But you know what I mean.
You're putting a lot. Yeah. Okay. I see what you're saying here.
In mythological terms, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The screaming all sounds like it's coming from out there, the upstairs.
Metaphor.
And there's a distinct sword clanging, sword hitting the ground sound that sounds like it's coming from behind her. That might just be my perception, but I'm willing to believe that Ciri at least disarmed or knocked out Meryn Trant and got away.
Hmm.
So, and Meryn Trant would absolutely hide the fact, and Ciri's not that big a player that it would really matter because he's not going to cause a revolution. He just, I'm thinking maybe he got away.
Is it possible that he's alive in the books but is dead in the show?
Potentially. I think everything I just said is really grasping at straws, but I'm aware of that, but I'm still saying it.
I get it. We all want Ciri to be alive. He's such a cool guy. He's got the coolest accent on the entire show, obviously. What do we say to the god of death?
Mm-hmm.
If he was alive, he would have shown up by now. I think that's kind of in the show.
definitely in the show. Yeah,
I think if he was alive, he would have shown up sometime like two seasons ago.
And like, there's a whole theory about how he and Jaqen H'ghar are actually the same person.
Yeah, and I don't buy that one. I don't buy that one.
I don't think I do either. But
because,
I'm just
like,
throwing it out there.
What business does Jaqen H'ghar have with Arya at that point? Like,
you don't know that Jaqen H'ghar is really, that's his real identity.
No,
that
I know, but like, no, you know what I mean? Okay, assumed. We're just using that as a placeholder name.
Right.
But like, that person, character, who works for the House of Black and White,
They worship the god of death.
Right.
Like, seriously, like,
again, but how
that's the Bravosi in him coming out, but.
Sure, but again, what from like a motivational standpoint, why would that character with the name Jaqen H'ghar, we'll just use a placeholder, be interested in Arya at that point in her life?
Again, I'm playing devil's advocate.
Unless she can see the future, which they don't give any hint that they can see the future.
No, but she's clearly predisposed to that lifestyle. And I was about to say, why would the Three-Eyed Raven reach out to Bran?
Well, that's different because the Three-Eyed Raven can see the future.
Yeah. Well, and it's obvious that the House of Undying, the House of the Undying, the House of Black and White, it's a different magic. It's in season two. They obviously have magical powers and prophecy and that kind of stuff too. So again, grasping at straws, have the tinfoil hat.
People just need to might be come to terms with the fact that he's probably dead in the show.
Yeah,
and if you wanted to be alive, there's still a much stronger possibility that he'll reemerge in the books.
And
probably, then you're the one who's read them. I don't know.
And again, I think coming back, bringing it, we were talking about serial for much too long.
Yeah, there's a lot of scenes in this episode.
Bringing it back to that, the theme that I was discussing earlier, the theme of injustice, of, so in theory, a character like Ciri should be the badass, should get out of there. He should escape.
Right.
And he doesn't.
And it shows all about.
And that's the larger theme.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's all about subverting expectations.
Exactly.
Right?
So he should die there, even though he's the good guy.
Especially this season, by the way. That's like the staple of
Fair
this
enough.
Season.
Yeah. That's much more likely.
Okay. So there's also a brief scene where the Hound finds Sansa, and this is like the first of many like very weird scenes between these two over the next like couple seasons. I forgot about that kind of whole weirdness. I kind of wish I kept forgetting about it.
Yeah.
It's not great stuff. I'm glad that they kind of dropped it all together.
Well, it makes it easier to like the Hound, but he became such a fan favorite that he has so much charisma. Now in season 7, yeah, he's imagine, like a good guy.
Yeah, he comes back and like he's just another like pedophile like lecher yeah. like kind of dude. It's like,
well, that's the whole
weird.
Point is that every like people are there's a spectrum.
Yeah.
You're not good or bad, you're in between. And he sends off some very rapey vibes.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot.
He does.
It's worse in the books, I promise you.
Okay, well, I don't want to he's another he's you know, really you're not convinced me to read these books by saying
you gotta
that.
Read the like, books. That's not what's gonna draw you're not gonna enjoy reading that. But
what
overall
if I, what if I just listen to the audiobook?
It's not the same. It's good, but it's not the same.
Oh, I get that argument. That's not I'm having that one with you right now.
We can't.
I don't want to. No, we already talked about this in one year, you're actively participating in the story. This is the I'm not having this argument with you right now.
Okay.
Other than the fact that by listening you are engaging with it on a different level.
But it's inherently a passive activity. Okay, let's move on.
That's stupid. You're being stupid. all right. So, also Arya kills her first person. So yeah. That's speaking of loss of innocence.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? By accident, though, obviously.
Well, she tells him to stay away and she's pulling out the sword. It is absolutely an accident. Yeah. But, and there's a weird moment where she kind of like, you know, it's like a sociopath when they kill their first kitten. Like, she's not.
Wait, is that like.
That's
the,
like a
is,
thing.
Wait.
That's
is that
a
like
thing.
The,
I don't know if that's. Like, I don't know if there's a common analogy.
Wait, are you. Wait a minute. Wait, have you killed a kitten?
No, but I'm not a sociopath, right?
I don't know. If you've killed a kitten, that's a different whole. That's a whole different story.
But like, she's not entirely horrified. She's kind of like belies a little curiosity almost.
Mm.
Like she's into, like not into like, it.
What have I done? Oh, what have I done? It's more of like, what have I done? Oh, wait a minute.
It's more like she's like confused, but sort of
what
wants,
have I,
this, wants
what
to see it again.
What have I done?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, there you go. That was the proper inflection. And there's a part that's cut from the show that's I like from the books, and I think Martin fought for it, but eventually it was cut out. The kid, when she stabs him, he's also as confused. Like, it's such a surreal event to be stabbed. I can't imagine. But like, and he's like, pull it out. That's what he says.
Oh, man.
Because that's like how his brain is reacting. So it's I thought it was very poignant, but it doesn't make the show because that's kind of maybe a bit too disturbing for audiences.
Man, have you ever seen that? I don't know what it's on. If it's a Family Guy joke or Robot Chicken, where it's like Zaz from Batman.
Yeah.
And he's like, he like, tries, I don't know, is it Zaz? You know, yeah, he stabs, he like tries stabbing himself. He's like, oh, is that what it feels like?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Which is really funny. Okay. So let's move on. And that's a lot for the first bit. I mean,
for the first 10 seconds.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot, emotionally speaking, there's a lot happening here.
Right.
And from a plot's perspective, it's also very important. But this episode is very busy. And there's lots to talk about, so we should move on.
Well, and it's really quick, so it's important to really zoom in on those things and actually explore them.
All right, so Varys and Ned have a quick conversation. Ned is in the black cells, as they're called. And this is basically an exposition dump about what is, like, what him being captured means. It's basically, hey, this is what could and can happen based on what happened last week. Ned's pretty bitter about the whole thing. What really stands out is there's this line that Ned asks Varys, like, who do you truly serve? And it's a great line because he kind of uses it more later on, but he serves the realm.
He tells us time and time again, and we still don't fully understand what that means.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear. He's looking out for the best. He wants the best for the general regular people and whatever that means.
Okay, fair enough. Easy to say that. How effective has that been?
Well, I mean, it's not great. I mean, he's like, he started a couple wars. You know, that can't be good for the regular people.
He certainly didn't help a lot of people, from what I can see.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great virtue to kind of like spout or whatever, I guess. But in practice, maybe he's not very effective.
I'm still a huge, like a true believer in this theory that Varys is one of the Blackfyre Targaryens. So he's not necessarily out to help the realm, but to help
him. So he's a secret Targaryen.
Yeah.
Dan, no, we went over this last
I know,
season.
I know I said I want it to be like they're not like Cylons, that everyone's a secret Cylon.
Yeah.
But Varys is the one that it. Varys and,
no,
and probably
Daniel,
Tyrion
no.
and Jon, I guess.
No.
Shit.
There's
that's,
no.
That's too many.
There's no. So are you under the belief that there
so
is
much,
one more? That there's one more?
There's a whole subplot. Not even a subplot. There's a whole arc that's completely omitted from the show about the Blackfyre
Targaryens.
Right,
so we're talking about the show, though. So.
I know.
All right, so the theory that I had, that we, you know, that I was kind of bouncing around, that we were kind of talking about, was the fact that there's three dragons, right?
Dragon has three heads.
And there's three Targaryens, right? Thing is, though, there's now only two dragons. So...
But that, I mean, there were three.
Right. But that one is going to get killed, presumably, the ice dragon.
No.
You think that one's going to win? You think that, Dean, you know, think this is all
going
to end
with
the ice dragon?
I shouldn't have said no to that. I wasn't paying attention. I was saying no to something I thought about earlier. That dragon was resurrected, so was Jon Snow. It'll still work.
So there's okay. So, I guess no. I don't know. No. There's room for only two. Jon will ride one. Daniel will ride one. The other one will die. They'll win, but at a huge cost. That's the end. That's spoilers. That's how the end of the series will go.
I don't know. It's too predictable.
I mean, is a huge cost too predictable? Is it
a huge cost for sure?
Right.
That part,
but
is-
like. I don't think you can do 7-8 seasons of a show and then end on a down note. I just don't think you can do it. I just don't think, especially when we talk about like the way that the show has changed from season to season, and it's much more traditional now.
That's true.
In a sense, who wants to see the White Walkers win?
They're not going to win, but it's not going to be, well, okay, victory at a great cost, but like, to the point that it's not bittersweet is like the wrong word for it. You know, it's almost too much.
Just bitter
and morose.
just bitter.
I don't know. It's hard to predict.
Obviously.
But a lot of shows end that way. Like Sopranos, Breaking Bad.
Yeah. Well,
The Wire.
A lot of people don't really like Sopranos ending.
It had an abrupt ending, but it was
I'm also, by the way, I'm not a fan of that. I didn't watch a lot of Sopranos. I just don't like the idea that that's how the show ends.
But how? Okay, we're not going to get into it. I was going to say how could that show
just end? With like just give an answer. Just give people an answer to a show they've been watching for that long. I think that's all that people are asking.
Yeah, well,
for.
I can promise you, Game of Thrones.
Inception's a 2-hour movie. Yeah. You can leave it on a like, oh well, you know, okay, it could be any of these things, right?
Yeah.
Because that's obviously the most apt comparison, like the open ended. Mm-hmm. It could be anything ending, right? The idea that it cuts to black, I think, is almost insulting to a fan base. I mean, I guess I'll take that over the Lost finale, where it's all nothing matters kind of deal. But like, you know what?
I can guarantee you Game of Thrones is not going to just cut to black to end it.
Turns out it was all on the holodeck.
Yeah. Riker just steps through.
Computer. Freeze and, program.
And simulation.
Fat Riker though, like chubby.
Yeah,
Riker.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's been a few years.
Yeah, that's a funny reference. Okay, again, we spent much too long on a short scene. Okay, cut to Winterfell, and we have some dead bodies that they're carrying back. They did their vows last.
So you mean Castle Black?
What did I say?
You said Winterfell.
Yes, Castle Black. My bad. They're carrying bodies back. They did their vows, John and Sam and all of them. And they were also out there for another reason, right? It was to try to track down what happened with Benjen's whole expedition.
No,
right?
They just got lucky. Ghost found at the hand, and that led them to the bodies. They were just out there to say their vows in front of the Heart Tree.
Oh, no. A party searching for them before a different party.
Okay, the very first scene of the show is the party that went searching.
Right. Okay. Right.
No. Sorry. Other way around. Benjen and his party go searching for that party that died at the beginning of the show. Benjen goes out looking for them.
Yeah.
And then they haven't heard from them in a while, but it hasn't been that long that it's outrageous. They go to say their vows, and Ghost finds a hand.
Well, it's because but then.
Like they don't have
he
email.
He asks like he's like, well, what would you know? And like, did you guess you didn't find anything else? Is it kind of what he asks, right? Mormont.
Yeah, yeah. So they've been gone, like they missed, they didn't check in, but it's like it happens out past the wall. Like you get snowed in, you get stuck somewhere, you encounter wildlings or whatever else. So it's not uncommon for them to miss their due dates.
Why did I write Winterfell here? That's stupid. You know what it probably was? I was taking notes while I was watching it, and it cut to like a snowy thing. Yeah. And I just assumed it was Winterfell. Yeah, well. And then I didn't correct it once I just kept writing. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. So the bodies that don't smell, apparently, that's the dead giveaway.
And see, that's a dumb one. Like, for me, they're frozen.
Yeah, right? That's how I think a lot of people who write this stuff have never like
seen snow.
Have never like been out in like the like deep freeze of dead winter, right? Things don't smell in winter, man. I'm just gonna tell you, it's too goddamn cold.
That's how refrigerators and freezers work. It preserves things, right? Like, it doesn't go bad.
It's like, well, shouldn't there be some rot?
There is no rot.
No, it doesn't rot.
Freezes.
That's why you get those like those bodies in like the Himalayas that are like completely preserved.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So
yeah, there wouldn't be a smell. But whatever. It's not a big deal.
It's just like one of those things. Like, but notice that smell? No, because there isn't one. Like, it's just kind of a silly thing. They're just trying to foreshadow that something was going to happen. It's fine. They're interrupted by a squire, someone saying that a raven from King's Landing has arrived, and
I don't think it's squire. I'm pretty sure that's like Bowen Marsh or one of the main. No,
just another like knight.
I think he's the head steward or something. Like that.
It turns out it's news for John.
It's news for the Lord Commander.
Well, news for the Lord, but that's why he brings John in. That's why
he allows John access to the information.
We cut back to he's in his room and he's like, "Hey, go get me a horn of ale, by the way."
So cool.
Very cool. That's another, like, I don't know if everyone else would have called it a horn of ale. Like, I think that might be one of those George R. R. Martin.
No. Well, okay. But that's like a Viking thing.
No, like, I know, but like, it's just very cool.
Yeah, it's so cool. It makes me want to kill an animal and use his horn to drink out of it. But I'm never going to do it.
No,
like,
and also it's impractical. How do you put it down?
You can figure that out.
No, like I guess they show the cups or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, it was like the top and the...
It's not just a horn. Like, it's a horn fashioned into a cup.
Mm. You know what? Anyway, news for John. Well, news for Lord Commander. News for John. Turns out he's just telling him... a lot of this happens in this episode where people are filled in on all the things that we knew already, right? Which, by the way, we've talked about in later episode, like later seasons, when characters meet each other after a long time, where it's not interesting for the audience to have those characters explained all the things that we've seen already.
Right.
It's different in one season where it's like there's less things to go over, but it's something they actively try to avoid doing in later seasons because it's bad writing. It's bad television.
I don't know if it's bad writing. Like, it has to happen. And for me, it's not, yes, it's information we're aware. This isn't exposition. We already know what's going on, but what's interesting is seeing these characters react to the information that they're receiving. Yeah. That's the story that's being told here. John reacting to it.
Yeah, so John's pissed. He like gets up and Lord Commander tells him, "Don't do anything stupid," right? He's worried about his sisters. He's like, "My sisters are still down there." Like, he's gonna run over to King's Landing. I don't know. We cut over to Sansa. Speaking of his sister, cut over to Sansa. She's talking with Cersei and the small counselor there. There's some pretty harsh words by Pycelle kind of thrown around. It's particularly the ones talking about how she's from the seed of a traitor, which seems particularly harsh.
Yeah.
Just like
the crimes of the father.
Yeah. He's like, "Well, it's not from now, but in 10 years.
But the thing you got to remember about all this, the four of them there are just playing a game. They're acting. It's good cop, bad cop. And Cersei is the good cop because she knows that Sansa is absolutely willing to believe her because that's her idol. So she knows she can take advantage of that.
Came in before Sansa comes in. Okay. So you're gonna play bad cop. I'll be good cop.
More or less. We learn later on that Pycelle was a Lannister agent from the get-go for the longest time.
Well, yeah.
Right? And then Varys and Littlefinger aren't that invested in Sansa. Littlefinger is later on hugely invested in Sansa. But at this it benefits them to play along with this game.
Yeah,
and those four, because that's how things work in King's Landing. They are all aware, even if they didn't meet ahead of time to do a game plan, but they're all aware of what's going on.
You got to be smart to play the Game of Thrones.
Exactly.
Okay. So, anyway, some mean stuff said. You're right. Cersei's playing good cop. Tells Sansa to write a letter to Rob, saying that, hey, it's all fine. Just swear fealty to Joffrey. Everything's all good. Right.
And there's an inadvertent dig there that I really appreciate. Pycelle says something about how, you know, she's cute now, but in 10 years she'll hatch a plan.
Yeah.
And then Sansa says something like, I'm paraphrasing, something to the effect of, you know, I'll be a good queen. I'll be just like
I'll
you. I won't hatch anything because Cersei could never have Robert's children.
Right.
In the show that they created this, like at this little brown haired baby that, you know, died shortly after birth or whatever, but I don't think that's part of the book. So the fact is Cersei could only have Jaime's kids and never had any of Robert's.
Yeah.
And that's something that was kind of a sore spot for her.
So do you think she took it? They cut to her face and she's kind of like, ugh.
She kind of like flinches a little, like it's very subtle, but she flicks her eyes up and then she knows that Sansa.
I thought it was more like a, like, ooh, phrasing, you know? Or like a plotty kind of like, no, you won't hatch anything. Kind of like, what is this? What do you do? What is this called when you do like the Mr. Burns finger thing?
Yeah, that's what it's called, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, excellent.
Yeah. Just an evil, I don't know what it's called.
Like the touch your fingertips with the other fingertips.
Everybody listening knows exactly what you mean.
No, but like they can't
say it's,
they can't
Mr. Burns, excellent. They all see it. Yes. Everybody sees it in their head.
And if you don't know, I mean, like, it's probably, that's a pretty easy Google, I'd say.
Fair enough.
All right. Because there's probably a super cut of how many times she said that. In fact, I have not looked.
Yeah.
But I would bet my life savings, which is mostly in debt. But
yeah. Which is if you lose, people owe you money.
Yeah, that's right. Well, no, they just owe the bank money.
Right.
But you can buy my debt. That's a thing. Yeah. People do that all the time. Yeah. So, okay. So what are we talking about? We're talking about writing the letter. So we cut from her writing the letter to Rob reading the letter, right? And this is, I think, an early example of the show's willingness to play with time an episode written by George R. R. Martin himself. So these people that complain about this all the time, it come up a lot in the later seasons about their ability to just jump around, blah, blah, blah. Things are happening. It's plot driven instead of driven by the rules of the reality of the show. So we'll just make it whatever works based on what the script asks for. Right.
Fair enough.
This is, I think, an example of that. Of course, you could say that the cut is like a takes a long time. There's the time between cuts is a certain amount of time. I just think it's like clearly the show from the beginning was more concerned about the plot than it was about the rules of how long it takes a raven to fly from one place to another.
And even still, just to, again, play devil's advocate, having another scene in between would make a world of difference. It wouldn't feel jarring.
But you had to understand like the thematic reasons.
Exactly.
You go from
it's the same
writing
letter.
A letter to, exactly.
Right.
So,
no, I get that. And it's also different when it's a letter than when it's Varys in the same episode appearing on two opposite sides of the world with a sea in between.
Mm-hmm. No, I get that. Yeah, I understand like, though, but I'm just saying that this, I think it's a good example of that.
Right.
The show has always concerned itself more with this than it has been the
other thing.
Fair enough.
And, you know, in small doses, it's probably fine.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think this is a great line that we get, like the, where he's like, says, these are, who's it that says it? It's Maester Luwin, right? And he's like, yes, it's your sister's writing, but it's the queen's words.
Right.
I think it's such a great line. It just, I don't know why I like it so much. It kind of shows off how wise Luwin is, mm-hmm. right? And great of a counsel he is.
I was going to say Maester Luwin is severely underrated, but I don't think he is. I think everybody loves him for obvious reasons. I think he's just badass because he's so good at what he does. And he can
see through the veil. I mean, it doesn't seem like Rob right away kind of picked that up. He's kind of confused. Like, why would my sister write this? Right. And he's like, let me explain why your sister would write this, you know? But he's still young, Rob. And we all know how that turns out for him. So, he tells Luwin to call the banners, which again is, I think, one of the coolest, another really cool thing to just say.
Right.
Like, just call the banners. And he's like, all of them.
Loved that. Another example of Maester Luwin being cool.
Yeah.
He understands the gravity of the situation. Right. He's like, and he knows the answer when he asks, but he has to ask.
All of them.
Yeah.
Just so cool. So And then, by the way, when he says that, Theon gives this little shit-eating grin.
Right.
He, like, looks up. He's like...
Well, he's wanted this all his life. Yeah.
Yeah, he's like, yo, here we go.
Finally.
Woo! You know, I like that, too. And then afterwards, Theon asks him if he's afraid. I think it's a nice... It's a very small moment, but I think it's a very... It's a great moment where he says, are you afraid? And his hand is shaking, right? And he's like, I guess so. Like, good. Means you're not an idiot. You know? It gives Theon a little bit, just a little bit more, because he hasn't really had a lot to do.
Not this season. Yeah, he's been a douche this whole season, right?
Right. So we kind of give this moment, this small moment, just says like, hey, he's not a complete idiot. He's not just like this, this useless character. He knows something about something, and he's got at least some advice for Rob, right? So I think that's important. So we cut to the Eyrie. I mean, there's going to be a lot of these. We just cut back and forth nonstop in this episode. And Catelyn is pissed, right? It turns out, I guess, her sister kept this information from her all day, and she knew from, like from dawn. And she comes up saying, like, well, what are we going to do about this, right? And basically asking for help from Knights of the Vale. And this is the first time they'll get asked for help. And I just think it's so interesting that they don't actually do anything until season six.
Right.
They just sit there doing shit all.
Think about that. What they did in season six to save Winterfell, they could have just done right now. Season one. It would have been huge.
It would have been so many things. Like, think of the dominoes that would, like, the ripple of, but sorry. There's a lot of different things you can say.
The domino ripple effect.
Butterfly effect.
Think about how those dominoes ripple.
I was really trying to say the butterfly effect of how
it's all of those things.
If they jumped if they jumped in here,
it would have been the North, the Eyrie, and the Riverlords against the South.
Right.
And the Reach wouldn't have
The Frey was
it would have been them versus the Lannisters.
Lord Frey would have probably no reason to do the whole thing that he did.
Exactly. He would have sided with them.
He would have reason to. He just wouldn't have means to do it.
He saw an opportunity and he did what he did. He would have sided with them because that would have been the most convenient
The smartest move, yeah. So there would be no show, basically. But yeah.
But these made-up characters would be a little bit happier.
That's right. Anyway, so they don't help. That's the gist of that. They don't help. And Kat
is more concerned with protecting her child than anything else.
Right.
And doesn't want to risk anything.
So he's like, she is just like, all right, well, I'm out of here then. You got nothing for me. Yeah, there's no reason for me to stay. So she takes off. And then we cut to Bronn and Tyrion, not far away, probably. And they're walking through, I guess,
the Vale.
The Vale, yeah.
The Vale of Arryn.
And they're chit-chatting. Bronn's kind of hinting at, like, hey, like, I'm going to need a raise kind of deal. And it's fair. I think it's a fair comment. So it's just kind of fun banter. A couple lines that stick out for me. He says that Bronn says, I'm not your friend, right? You know, I'm just here. I'm just working for you. I'm not your friend, all that kind of stuff. And then in response to that, Tyrion says, well, if it ever comes to a time where you might like sell me out, just know that I'll beat your price or beat the price, whatever, all that kind of stuff. So with that in mind,
like any good manager, it's easy to say that.
Right.
You don't have to put up anything. You just say that. Trust me. Just keep working hard. Just keep working really hard.
Look,
trust me. It's
and someone will pay you.
People are noticing your work ethic.
Yeah.
You know, you're gonna get somewhere. You're gonna gain traction.
Yeah. Dan's a little bit bitter. but I was gonna say is think to the scenes in this most recent season, season 7. Sorry, season six, seven episodes, seven seasons.
One was 7, yeah.
Right. And I'm just trying to think if this was in season 6 or 7, but it was in season 7. And when Tyrion goes to have that secret meeting with Jaime, who does he go to get that secret meeting? He goes to Bronn, right? And that is that not a prime opportunity to sell someone out? And that at the same time that Tyrion is not in a means to actually pay anyone anything. Mm-hmm. I just think that's the growth there is just so interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
When you just look at it from those two distinct points of view. At this, the first time they're really hanging out, I'm not your friend. I'll always pay you. This is always just this is a business relationship kind of thing. Clearly they're friends, right? By the time we see them.
Yeah, it evolves.
And that he chooses clearly not to sell him out, right? Even Jamie's like, or no, is it Cersei was like, hey, your man kind of like let this happen. You're not, what are you going to do about it? And he says nothing. He's like, he doesn't do anything about it, basically. Yeah. Right. So I just think that's really interesting. They are then attacked by, they go to sleep, I guess. And then they're attacked by Hills Tribes people, the Stone Crows. And Tyrion manages to talk his way out of this whole situation, as he does.
Right? Yeah, he has a tendency to do that.
But the thing that he does here is he overpromises a bit. He says to promise to give them the veil, which I don't think he really is in any position to give that or offer that, but they don't know that.
But exactly.
They
don't know. And he knows that they don't know that.
Yeah.
That's how Tyrion thinks.
Yeah. So it's another one of those well-written, great scenes with Tyrion getting the best dialogue. It's good. Is there anything else you want to say about anything that I've talked about the Eyrie?
The Hill Tribes, the Stone Crows, whatever, they all kind of get forgotten later on in the series.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things in this episode that are distinctly forgotten and never touched on again. And I think on purpose, but we'll get to those.
Because they're obviously never going to get the Vale of Arryn for themselves. They're
They're
just a bunch of dudes that they're just soldiers. That's all it is, unfortunately. Unfortunately, I don't really care about just, the Hill Tribe.
They're just the pawns. They're just the pawns, right, guys. All right, so we move on. Where were we? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, go cut to Winterfell. No, I did it again.
Are you sure?
I did it again. No, I wrote it again. I did it twice.
Oh.
I think
That signifies a pattern. That's not a coincidence.
Twice is a coincidence. I wrote this in a tweet today. Actually, yesterday, about the season... the episode 7 episode we did, I said, once is a fluke, twice is a coincidence, and then anything after that is a trend.
Right.
Right. So twice is a coincidence.
Okay. Well, let's see what happens later on.
In the tweet, it was referencing the fact that we've been only back for 2 weeks in a row. So I was like, I'm holding off calling it a new streak until this episode that we're recording right now comes out.
Right.
Which I think I can confidence saying, because we're recording it right now.
It's going to come up.
Then it'll come up, right? I'm looking at the computer just making sure it's still recording. And it is. It is. Okay, so we're good. We're good. All right, so we're at Castle Black. And Commander Mormont confines Jon to his quarters after he tries stabbing...
Sir Alistair Thorne.
Right. For insulting his father, calling him a traitor. He was just kind of goading him, though. It's so obvious.
But this is John letting it get the best of him.
And even Mormont's like, I told you not to do anything stupid. Like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Right? But it's like, I know. I would get it.
Would have been a much bigger deal were it not for what happens next.
Indeed. We cut away. It's nighttime now. And Ghost is like freaking out, like scratching at the door. A lot of like whiny dog sounds. They're the saddest of all sounds, I think.
Yeah. It's heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
And that's a point that a lot of purists, I wouldn't count myself among them.
Right.
A purist in certain senses, but like this thing doesn't really matter to me. Ghost is supposed to be always silent. He doesn't bark. He doesn't growl. He doesn't whine. He doesn't howl.
Can be perfectly silent.
I know, but that's the thing. He's unique and this is a part of his character, but it doesn't make or break the show to have him growl. And it makes sense for this scene because you have to show it, right? You have to have it give Jon an impetus to go out there.
Right. Also, it would be really hard to cut out that sound, I think. But it's neither here nor there. Like I said, Ghost is freaking out. He's like, okay, let's go figure out what's going on. They go over to Commander Mormont's quarters, and then they are promptly attacked by one of the
Otho.
One of the dead bodies that was brought in.
His name was Otho.
Now, here's one of those things that we'd mentioned about, like, things that happen in this episode that are brought up and then never mentioned again. And this might be on purpose, might not be. They just want to not talk about it. Jon burns his hand throwing the lantern here. You can tell because it goes when he throws it.
And he screams, yeah.
Yeah. This is used as an example for years, by the way, as the show went on. That scene, this exact scene was used as an example of why Jon could not be a secret Targaryen.
Yeah.
Right? Now, where did we come down on the whole Targaryens can be burned thing? Or is that just Dany's superpower?
No, it's not. Okay. It really does seem like Targaryens are immune to fire. That is explicitly not the case. Okay? Daenerys, when she burns Khal Drogo, and she's performing blood magic. The magic is what protects her, not her Targaryen heritage.
What about the part when she walks into the water? And
yeah, it's hot water.
Yeah, it's but not she the does, she's like, it's too hot, and she's not making any, like, she makes no motion. She picks up the egg then. She picks up the egg out of the fire.
She doesn't have, you're right.
Yeah.
The other thing that they say about Targaryens, though, when a Targaryen is born, the gods flip a coin. One side is greatness, the other side is insanity. And presumably traits like this are decided by that theoretical coin flip. So
really what you're trying to do is defend the show's inconsistency.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's in the books as well. But
does he burn his hand in the books?
Yeah, absolutely. And he's bandaged for a while. By the way, when Daenerys, she burns all her hair off, all her clothes off. Like, she is just not, she doesn't have, like...
really? She's bald in the show?
Yeah, in the well, for the whole second book, basically. Hmm. She doesn't have these, like, pyro powers that she shows in, what, season 6 or whatever it is, where she, like, throws the fire at the guy. Like, she's knocking down the pyres, and it really looks like she's just, like, X-Men mutant powers.
Yeah, I mean...
I think the immunity to fire is a part of Daenerys' character. I think maybe the show took it a bit too far, and I think people are reading into it too much. That does not define a Targaryen.
No, okay. But it's one of those inconsistencies that's
and Jon's not problematic. Jon's not full Targaryen either way. So
That's true.
Deal with it.
I'm just saying that this is one of those scenes.
No, it's important to talk about it. Like, it makes sense that it's brought up.
All right, so we now go across to Essos, speaking of Dany. And the Dothraki are doing their whole raping and pillaging thing.
Right.
And Dany seems very concerned about it, even though she almost just died, but she's very emotional, I guess, right now. She's told that they plan to sell the people to the slavers in exchange for goods and gold. Presumably, they say in this episode to rent ships or whatever.
Yeah.
So Dany sees some woman being about to be raped. She's obviously very sensitive about this issue. She orders them to stop. And Jorah tells her that this is the way it's always been. Now, I think it's interesting that Jorah is kind of cautioning acceptance of slavery, considering his whole backstory. Yeah,
he has a history of slavery.
Right?
But it does make sense, because his history with slaving is that it's a practicality.
Yeah. Anyway, this is where she finds the witch,
Miri Mazdur.
Yeah, it's a moment of this whole episode. Danny's making some strange choices in my mind. This one is fine. The whole idea of preventing rape.
Yeah,
it's fine.
We're on that side.
Yeah, it's later on where you're just like, it's like, is that really a good idea? You know, in full context, is that really a good idea?
So I don't mean to belabor this point, but that is her demonstrating her innocence. Mm-hmm. And the Miri Mazdur is one of her betrayals. Like, there's a whole thing with Quaithe and the prophecy, how she'll have three betrayals.
Really?
Yeah.
How Jesus-y.
Exactly. But that's how she internalizes it. So this is her innocence betraying her, because she believes this woman would earnestly try to help her because she helped the woman. And that's not the case. Miri Mazdur says later on.
But she was only into this whole situation in the first place because of what her husband was doing. I know. It's like, you know what
I
mean?
Yeah, yeah. But everyone has their own personal motivations, and Dany couldn't see that. Miri Mazdur has every reason to hate the Dothraki, especially Khal Drogo.
Yeah. I mean, Drogo does some pretty stupid shit in this episode too, to be fair.
Well, he's overconfident. I mean,
yeah. It's dumb. It's a dumb move. It's very cool.
He just lets it. But here's the thing. If it weren't for Miri Mazdur, he would have been fine. So he doesn't really do it. The dumb thing he does is listen to his wife, I guess. But that you can't really call that dumb.
Yeah, okay. Let's tread the whole thing here. Yeah. So she tells them to stop, and that prevents some of the Dothraki, like, people from not being able to get their spoils, as it were.
Right.
They go and complain to Drogo.
Mago specifically.
Yeah. And she comes and says, like, hey, well, deal with it. I am in charge of you, even if you don't like it. Drogo's like, yeah, she's right. His exact line is, go find your blank, you know, go find you a place to put your blank somewhere else. Right. Which is pretty cool line.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's effective.
Yeah. And he doesn't like that. So he spits on towards him and challenges him, Drogo. And this whole scene is very cool. Drogo's like sitting in this like the coolest spot you could possibly sit in.
Yeah. He's got a pile of heads next to him. He's a warlord.
And there's like a giant statue of a ram.
And he's just leaning on his yeah. arak.
Yeah. Scythe, basically.
Yeah.
And
just the conqueror.
Very cool. Just looking ripped. And so he starts to fight him. And the first thing he does is just walk straight into his blade. Now, listen, I'm all for being badass. All right. That's just a stupid idea. It's just a bad idea. Well, that is just poorly. It's just not a good idea. I don't know how to put it.
He's so above it. Like, he's so next level that the guy couldn't.
That's the only wound he could, like.
Yeah, he has to let him. Like, the guy couldn't bother him at all. And he obviously proves it. He drops his weapons. He kills him with his bare hands.
Mm-hmm. He literally rips his throat out.
He rips his tongue out through his throat. how gangster is that?
Throat ripper.
Tongues are supposed to go this way.
It's MacGruber. Just throat ripping left and right. It's so brutal.
And Jason Momoa fought for that because you hear so much about how Drogo is the greatest warrior.
But you
blah,
never
blah, blah.
See it. You never,
in the books, you don't really see it. In the books, the injury that he gets that festers is mm-hmm. from the battle. It's just like, it's a scratch, but she has Miriam Azdur clean it anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this whole thing with Mago doesn't happen. Mago actually becomes a character later on in the books. Not important. Well, less important.
Yeah. It's not important because this character dies in this episode. Right. So it doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah, I mean it's very cool. This fight scene is like very cool. I mean, we've seen a lot of really awesome fight scenes in the show. I think this one is underrated in just how quick and effective it is.
Right.
You know, just get right down to business. A little bit of showboating, and then boom, you're done. You know,
and it really establishes Drogo as a dangerous man, like unstoppable.
Even though we don't, again, this is like the only time we see it.
Right. Right.
And then. So he has the wound, and then he's like, no, it's fine. It's a scratch. Even like just like spreads the blood across himself. It's very cool again. But Danny's like all like, oh, no, I don't like seeing you bleeding. You're hurt. Bring this stranger here to help you. And then even the other person. And the worst part is this person's like, oh, a witch. Great. No, we've heard enough of her speak. We don't need her help.
Right.
We're fine. She even calls for the healers. Presumably they have their own.
That's right? The thing.
Why would you? You don't need this person. They are not in. They don't need. They're not needed to be there. Is she trying to make a point? Is she trying to make a point that hey, we can trust these random strangers. We don't need to rape them. They're trustworthy people. Because if that's what that's the point she's trying to make. Maybe that makes sense. But if you're just trying to help your sun and your stars, then this is not a good idea.
Yeah, they have plenty of other handmaidens that could have done that. Yeah. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
So that's.
But she also believes that Miriam Azdur has healing powers that the Dothraki don't have. That she also believes that she's indebted to her because.
Well, you don't need special healing powers. It's just a scratch. I mean, it's more than just a scratch. It's a pretty big wound, actually. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right, so let's cut away to Winterfell.
Are you sure this time?
Yeah, this one.
It's not Castlevania.
This time for real.
Okay,
it's cool. Time for real.
I just want to make sure I'm on the same page.
No, this time for real. The Winterfell, and this is my favorite scene of the entire episode. It's not even close. Actually, I mean, we just had this dope fight scene with Khal Drogo, but no, this scene is the best one. So Lord Umber, who I feel like we just don't nearly get enough of in the entire series in general.
Yeah, fair point.
Lord Greatjohn, that's his name, is boasting that he should lead the vanguard. Over the Glovers. He says, he has so many good lines in this episode. He says that the wall will melt before an Umber follows a Glover into battle, which is, I think, is a deep dig.
Yeah.
But we don't really know any of these characters, so it's subtle to us. It's like, it's just a cool thing to say. And John's not really having any of it.
Rob.
But I wrote John here, though.
You're falling apart, man.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, Rob is not having any of it. I'm not used to talking about Rob. We haven't talked about Rob for so long. And he calls him an oath breaker, you know, in what is a pretty cool speech. Very George R. R. Martin type speech. Right. Very cool stuff. And which is followed by a line by Greatjohn calling Rob so green he pisses grass, which is, again, amazing. right? And I think that this whole scene is like just pure George R. Martin doing his thing. This is just his shtick right here.
Well, it is basically word for word from the book what's happening right now. So
okay, and makes sense. Grey Wind then attacks him as he's like about to like pull his sword or whatever, and then bites off a couple fingers. And then another great line. It's just nonstop great lines where he says, you know, it's treason to pull a sword on your king.
It's death to draw steel against your liege lord. And he's like,
presumably he was just trying to cut my meat. And he looks at his fingers and says, it was some tough meat. And then starts laughing like a maniac.
Right. And he is a maniac.
How amazing is that, though? I was smiling ear to ear this entire time.
Right.
It is so fun.
It really gets across the point of Northern culture, the sort of mix of barbarism, but still ritual, like honor systems and that kind of stuff.
Well, also kind of the whole idea of like, yeah, you might have the title, but you have to like do something to like earn
the respect. Yeah.
Right. Even though it was his dog that did it, but you know what I mean? You know,
it was him forgiving the crime. And like understanding the status quo.
But the idea taking fingers is also still pretty, you know, impressive.
Yeah, of course.
we usually wait till the end of the episode, but I'm just like, spoilers, this is my favorite scene. That's easily my favorite scene. It just, the show doesn't really get, like, people lose fingers in it, but I feel like the show doesn't get that as light very often. Mm-hmm. It's just very fun.
I don't know what my favorite scene is.
Well, figure it out. You gotta figure it out. So we cut to John and Bran and Rob and Bran. Fuck.
God damn it.
Just assume that every time I say John, I mean
unless
Rob.
You're talking about the great John.
I don't know, John Aaron, or any of the million
other Johns and Robs.
Yeah, so this is Rob and Bran, and we're still at Winterfell. Man, this is really brutal. I'm really upset with myself.
It's okay. I'll always correct you.
Anyway. Telling him that he's telling Bran that he's off to war, right? Basically, this is the last time they see each other. Very sad. There must always be a Stark of Winterfell. So yep. He leaves Bran in charge.
And it also demonstrates a bit of Rob's strategic mind. They're stealing a night's march on Tywin.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they're gaining a day on him.
They're leaving in the dead of night because no one expected them to do that.
Right.
So they're gaining a little bit of time.
Showing again his clever military mind.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rickon appears out of nowhere.
He gets a line.
Gets a line here. First of all, this is the original Rickon. He was recast later on.
I don't think he was, man.
Yeah, he was. Rickon was recast.
I'm almost 100% sure he wasn't.
Rickon was recast.
We'll have to look it up later.
I will bet you on this one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now is not the time, but...
Yeah, okay, Rickon was recast. It's fine. And so this is crazy to me. So this whole thing is so strange. He has this line, like he's like a fucking seer, says about like how, like, don't worry, they'll be back. It's fine. He'll bring mom with him. And he says, no, they won't. And he like walks off like a ghost. Are we supposed to assume that he has some sort of...
No.
Or just that he's just very... pessimistic.
he's just a depressed kid that his whole family abandoned him and he has nowhere to turn to. Like Rickon, it's a sad story because he never had a chance. He's tiny.
He never really had a chance. Even if everything had gone well to begin with, nothing ever happened and everything was fine.
Well,
and
then he had a chance at a happy life.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. He had no chance to be like a great Stark or anything.
Well, most people don't have that chance, but most people can still enjoy their lives. Like,
well, yeah, don't get me wrong. I understand that. Yeah,
I mean, he never had a chance. Like, well, no. Even if he weren't murdered, like he never had a chance at a normal life. He lost his parents. Like, not normal. That's the wrong way to put it. The way that the family dynamic was changed on him without him receiving any sort of support structure. Losing both parents early, and then Rob leaves, the form of authority leaves, all that kind of stuff. Like, for him to come back from that, he needed a support system that wasn't there for him.
Mm-hmm.
From a character perspective.
I feel like spending any more time talking about Rickon would be a waste of our time, considering he gets the shortest shrift, I think, of any character with the last name Stark. we'll say. Or even really anyone with like a powerful name. Like I feel like other more minor characters get more to do. Like
Dickon.
Tywin's brother gets more to do.
Well, Kevin Lannister's a big part of the, well, whatever.
Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. I do know what you mean. Like,
so I'm just saying. Poor Rickon. May he rest in peace. So we move on. Asha and Bran were still in Winterfell. And they're in the Godswood. And Bran is making a prayer to the old gods. And I guess Asha kind of talks about like, oh, they're answering you. You know, can you hear it? And it's basically just listening to like the rustling of the leaves and the right. wind. Another cool line about like, oh, who brings the wind? Right. You know, cool line. And then she does this like this comment where she's like, the old gods have no power in the south, right? Because all the weirwood trees,
yeah,
were cut down. I think that's a kind of a cool, practical way of showing, like, because we know that there's magic in the show, right?
Right.
We know that some of the gods at least have some sort of power. Presumably, only the one that we've seen actually does anything.
Well, a couple. Bran's power is derived from the old gods.
I guess that's true.
He sees through the eyes of weirwood trees.
Yeah. Okay. So there you go. All
right. But he also, no, he has other visions that aren't like the Tower of Joy. There's obviously no weirwood tree there.
Yeah. It's like a desert.
But that's later on. Like initially he sees first through the eyes of like crows and then eventually through the eyes of weirwood trees.
Right.
Through time. Like he sees his dad praying at that same weirwood tree.
Anywho, what I'm saying is it's a cool way of expressing that, you know, these supernatural, being not even beings, these supernatural things that I
powers,
the,
yeah.
powers have a anchor in the physical world of the show, right? Whether that's the weirwood trees for the old gods or fire with
Rolor.
Rolor.
R apostrophe H.
Anyway, so that, I just think that's an interesting kind of small thing. Is even little lines like that always kind of stand out to me. And then Naked Hodor shows up. Flaccid penis.
Yeah.
Just to even things out, right?
Sure.
You know?
Just need a little dink every once in a while in the show.
again, to even things out, especially at this early in the show, there's a lot of like sex position going on. Yep. This is just even things out, balancing things out a bit. Is it the first mention of giants, I think?
I couldn't.
Somewhere, it's something it's like that. It's, if it's not the first, it's like the first like legitimate one because Bran's like, is there giants? And she's like, oh, there's way worse than giants. Let me tell you, You don't even know. You don't even know. Giant spiders. No, they don't do that in the show.
Not yet.
They don't do that in the show.
Not yet.
They don't do that in the show, Dan.
Giant ice spiders size of dogs.
They do not do that on the show. I'm making this very clear. This isn't a prediction. This is a request. And no, a demand. They do not do that on the show. I don't want to. I'm not interested in that.
Proper way to phrase that is they have not done it on the show.
No, they will not and shall not.
All right.
Yeah.
You're probably right. you're almost definitely right.
Yeah, okay. Asha then mentions that this is funny because I think this is like this line, a variation of this line is kind of is used a lot throughout the series. It's the idea that the armies are marching the wrong way.
Right.
That they should be going north, not south. It strikes me, especially at this moment when I was watching it, obviously I'm reading from my notes here. It strikes me that this episode has about as much foreshadowing for the whole White Walker threat as basically the rest of the series combined almost. Like, between this and the white that comes alive and this conversation, like so many things are talked about that stuff. And what Sam has to say, there's a scene, I think we kind of maybe glossed over it.
We did.
Where he's chatting kind of.
Because he read a book about the White Walkers and he said they were touched by the White Walkers. That's why they came back.
Yeah. So between those three scenes, over the next several years of the show, it's almost never touched on. Like it's very lightly touched on here and there.
Other than the scenes that you get with White Walkers.
Well, right. Which the ominous like bump, bump, bump. Like, yeah. But like in total, in regards to like the characters that we are following, interacting with that knowledge in some way. This is about as juicy as it gets in a single episode as you're going to get until like the latest season.
Especially for being south of the wall.
Oh, absolutely.
After that, everything north of the wall, yeah, you get the occasional reference. But other than that, after John goes north, nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So I just thought that was, it's like, and I think it's probably important because laying that groundwork now is important because it will become such a main part of the show by the end.
Right.
That I think it's important to lay those seeds early. Also, I think it's kind of interesting. It kind of pulls people in, keeps people on. They want to know more about what this is going on. Turns out you're just going to frustrate those people for the next like 6 years.
It's fine. It's world building. It's enticing people. It also makes a rewatch much more rewarding.
Mm-hmm. It does.
You know, you see, because even in the first season, they mention Mance Rayder. Doesn't become a part of the show until the third.
It's like a name drop. It's like, careful, you're dropping names. You better pick those up. You know,
that's what I said.
All right. So we cut to this time I wrote Castle Black for real.
I'll
show it to you. Look. Right at the top there.
All right. Okay. Checks out.
This is actually the scene we were just talking about Sam talking about the White Walker, so we can skip over that.
We're gonna gloss over it now. We hadn't yet, we will.
Oh, we were foreshadowing our glossing of the over. the Stark camp. Just for like, we don't know where it is exactly, but the Stark camp, and we see Catelyn arrive. Summer snows. John's brought the winter with him, apparently.
Rob, for the love of God.
That's what I said this time. It's what I said. And I wrote Rob here too. Rob talking.
That's fucking crazy.
I know, man. This is that dyslexia thing coming back at me real hard. Rob talking strategy as Jamie's armies kind of fall back. See, this is, I have a criticism, and I think I may hold it to the end or later on. But there's a lot of strategy talk in this episode.
Right.
This is one of them. So they're mentioning, they quickly mention here that the River Lords are on the heels of Jaime's armies.
Other way around.
I'll just say it now. The way that they handle the trying to explain what's happening where with which armies is not very well done.
And the map is not detailed at all.
No,
so you can't quite tell.
And they're really
head and two lion heads.
Right. They're just showing shots of like chess pieces, basically. It's not helpful. So I think this episode as a whole is pretty good. It's got some small issues. This is probably its biggest one, is that it does this a lot in this episode. It's people in camps talking about the things that their armies are going to do. Talk about dropping names. They're dropping names of locations like they're going out of style. And by the way, this is first season. We haven't been to most of these places. Like, we have no context for where these things are, or especially in relation to one another, even though they do the map at the beginning of the episode. Like, that, they're not showing us where the armies are.
Yeah, and it definitely flies over a lot of places.
Like, where, especially in this, where they are right now is not ever really shown.
The thing with the books, one of the things I love about fantasy books is you always have a map at the beginning of the book to go back and reference where
things are happening. And you can't expect a person watching TV carrying a map with them. Like, okay, wait a minute. Pause it. I want to know what they're talking about. Okay, hold on. This is where they are. This is what they're going. It's not well handled, especially when they put so much weight behind what's going to happen next week early on, about how Jamie's captured and all that kind of stuff. If you want that to land a lot better, I think you need to show why the move that Rob does is so strategically surprising, or whatever. So
I mean, they get it across verbally, but definitely not visually. They mentioned that there's two different armies. So you have Tywin's army, you have Jaime's army. Jaime's army is going after the River Lords. And even later on in the episode, there's a point where the Great Judge says, this is what it comes down to.
Yeah, that's very distinct. It's basically like from an RPG.
Yeah. And then you have the two, the red and the blue choice.
Yeah. And then if you wait long enough, it'll ask you again, this is what we can do. We can go after Tywin's army, or we can go after Jaime's army. I thought was pretty funny, just because it's like, we got to make this as clear as possible.
Right.
But I just think that everything else they were doing,
fair enough,
wasn't well handled. Okay, so Jamie's army is pushing back the River Lords. Why are the River Lords even involved in this? Because the mountain's been pillaging? Is that like...
Sorry?
Because the mountain's been going around pillaging? Yeah. That's why they're pissed off?
Okay. He went around burning villages and killing people. Right.
Did the River Lords then go to war with the Lannisters or before? Like, is that ever talked about?
The thing
like,
you
got to
remember
on?
Is at this point, the mountain is technically an enemy of the state. He's not acting on the... He is...
Because of what Ned said?
Yeah, he's a fugitive.
Right, okay.
So he's not acting on Tywin Lannister's orders, no, but that's although what, he actually
yeah,
is.
Yeah, but he is, and that's what Ned says. We talked about that, and he's like, that's yeah, such
he
a...
He says to bring Tywin yeah. Lannister to court to answer for the crimes of his bannermen.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that Tywin is in control of the mountain. Like, the mountain's the one that's going to die. Tywin just has to answer. Yes, it's complicated. Like,
yeah.
But Tywin, as far as anybody is concerned at this point, is still a law-abiding citizen.
Yeah. Okay.
Even though Lannisters are slaughtering Starks in the street right now.
Yeah.
It's weird. Because this is an age, there's no YouTube, so information travels.
Hey, it's what I said is true, or I'll kill you.
Right. So the Riverlords are at war against the mountain. Jaime and his troops are backing them up without, I guess people don't know about that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Rob's finding out about it. And
they take River Run, right? We find out that they take River Run.
They lay siege to River Run. Yeah. They haven't taken it.
Right. Okay. Right, so that's what they're saying. Come in, we can help them. We can help, like, free River Run, and then the River Lords will be on our side.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's, again, this is all that happens in multiple scenes.
Right.
Anyway, Catelyn arrives and looks at John.
No.
Rob.
Oh, my God.
I wrote John here. Again. Okay. I did it multiple times. Rob in the first paragraph, and then John in the second paragraph. I don't know what's wrong with me. Catelyn arrives and looks at Rob like every mom looks at her son when they can see that they've grown up in front of their eyes. Everyone has seen it. It's happened in every show and movie at least once when dealing with that kind of thing. It's very, very nice. And then they talk about strategy a little bit. He says that he has 18,000 men. That's important because he tells that scout later on. Turns out it's only 2,000 men difference. I don't know how much of a difference that actually makes in a practical sense. But that's the truth. He actually has 18,000 men. He has no reason to lie to his mom. He also mentions Catelyn basically references here that Tywin ordered the murder of children in their sleep. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Okay, that wasn't just hyperbole?
No.
Or is it spelt hyperbole?
That was, he ordered the mountain and some of his other generals to murder the Targaryen kids, can't remember what their goddamn names are. This is bad. Aegon and Rhaenys.
Right. Okay.
No. Whatever. The baby had his head smashed against the wall. The kid.
Like a baby?
A baby baby.
Was thrown against the wall.
The mountain smashes head against the wall like a watermelon.
What?
And the little girl was stabbed a good 30 times.
And people know this?
Yeah.
Tywin ordered this?
It's common knowledge. It's like it's a rumor, but right. It's basically
knowledge. And people were like, yeah, that's cool. Like, we're just cool with that?
They were, yeah.
Okay, then.
They were the children of the Mad King.
Yeah, still, though. Talking about crimes.
No, sorry. They were Rhaegar's children.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Can we pause for a second?
Let me think for a second. No,
Jesus,
we can't.
I've already made
enough mistakes. Now it's your turn to make mistakes.
Man, I'm going to reread the book soon. I should know that better.
Okay, but the point is, that's all I wanted to know, was whether she was...
No, yeah, they were certainly Rhaegar's
whether
children.
Whether she was being hyperbolic or not.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. Fuck that.
There's a really great moment here where they kind of talk about the stakes, you know, like what Rob's actions actually mean, you know,
right.
What every choice, you know, what is that? What weight does that have? And basically it's everything. Every choice he makes determines the life and death of either his father or his sisters
or everybody. But also basically. What choice does he have at this point?
Well, yeah, you can't go to war and be like, oops. Yeah. You know, but it's like, that makes it simple then. Right. It's what he says. The stakes are as big as they get as they've gotten in the show at this point, which is actually pretty fast that they got this high that quickly. About 2 weeks ago, they were not nearly this high. 2 weeks ago in show terms.
Yeah.
Right. 2 weeks ago, we weren't even doing shows. oh, crap. My notes just jumped around. Back up. Okay, there we go. So now we cut over to Tyrion and Tywin. So Tyrion arrives at Tywin's camp. I don't know how he knows where they are. That's strange, but not really a big deal.
They're kind of on the way.
He like walked past all of Rob's armies.
Rob's armies would have been further north yet.
Okay. So Tyrion squeezed past.
Is south of the neck.
Okay.
But southeast.
Anyway, obviously Tywin's very happy to see his son's not dead. Basically, the you know, the rumors of your demise have been greatly exaggerated kind of deal.
Right.
Tyrion introduces, this is another moment where the show gets really light. Tyrion introduces the Hill Tribe. It's very funny. And here's the thing that I want to ask you about. This is kind of a more deeper cut. This really has nothing, apropos of nothing. But he says, Tywin, son of Titan, or Tytos.
Tytos.
Who is Tytos? Do we know anything about him or anything he's done?
It's Tywin's father. He, yeah, so he was the head, the patriarch of the Lannister clan.
Right.
But he was also like the laughingstock of all of his bannermen. He was very easygoing, sort of, people made fun of him.
Loosey goosey.
Basically the opposite of Tywin.
Okay.
So, right. So Tywin, if someone talks shit, Tywin would not accept it. Right. This guy was sort of the opposite. He wanted everyone to be his friend. He was sort of open handed with his lords to the point that they didn't respect him, which led to the reigns of Castamere when Tywin butchered that whole house.
Right.
Right. Like for talking shit, essentially, for stepping up to him.
Hmm.
So that was how Tywin sort of solidified his rule in the West, although it was not in question necessarily. But he just proved to everyone that he's the complete opposite when he killed.
Right, and just
the reins and the Tarbecks.
Does Tytos just die of like natural causes, like in his bed in the sleep, or is unclear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically.
So there's another moment of Tyrion being caught up on all the stuff that he missed, and he just kind of just expedition of the things that have happened. A squire comes in and gives news about Rob's movements. Again, more strategy stuff. The only thing that is interesting here is that it's fun seeing Tywin's overconfidence when it comes to how he perceives Rob, right?
And Rob is acutely aware of that, which is evident with the way that he plays around with the Great John.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's calling him a green boy. That's why he lets the messenger go.
Literally everyone. I mean, yeah.
So he lets the messenger go to make Tywin think that he's overconfident, that he is the wolf rushing into the lion's jaws,
mm-hmm.
and it's all just a ploy.
That's not a saying, by the way.
But it makes sense in context.
I know, but it's like you just say that, like that's a thing that people say. That's not a thing people say.
Wolves and lions don't often meet.
Yeah, almost never.
Probably. Only in the Jungle Book.
Yeah, and maybe one occasionally in a zoo. Someone mixes up.
I don't think in real life. Maybe there are probably some wolves in. There are definitely no wolves in Africa. There are wild dogs and there are hyenas, but there's no wolves.
Yeah, yeah. So then no, because there's no lions anywhere else.
Yeah.
So anyway, speaking of which, are there
mountain lions?
Are there lions? Have we ever seen an actual lion in the Game of Thrones? Like
there are lions in the Dothraki Sea in Essos.
Okay.
I don't think there are lions anymore in Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were at one
hunted
point.
Hunted to extinction. Okay. Anyway, so we cut over to Rob's camp. This is where things get started. Did you just break that?
I did.
Oh, damn it. Come on. We only have so many of those rubber bands.
I'll replace this elastic
band. Who do you think you are, the rubber band man? That's T.I. You can't be rubber man.
You're right. You're goddamn right.
Rob's camp. Cut to more strategy talk as they decide whether they need to get help from Lord Frey, Catelyn's father's bannerman, to cross the river and free the River Run, or attack. So they can go after Tywin.
Either way, they have to cross the river.
Oh, is it okay? Wouldn't they if they want to come to them? Wouldn't they be the same thing, right?
More or less.
So they just sit on each side of the river and be like.
There are other ways around, but they take a long time. So this is the most efficient way around. I think for Rob and his army, time is of the essence.
Mm-hmm.
That's why this becomes prudent.
Okay. So they decide to face Jaime or Tywin, whatever. When they're in the middle of the conversation, when they capture this Lannister scout who was apparently counting people. It's a very strange line. You look like he was counting. Which is kind of funny.
He had an abacus.
Also, the idea that he counted 20,000, like, what were you basing that count off?
Well, you'd be counting tents or formations of tents and to say approximately this many people to a tent.
Right. So he thinks that there's about 20,000 people. This is what he asks. Rob asks the I really like actually when he walks in, he like flips the map up.
Theon does.
I thought it was Rob that flips the
map. Theon flips it, and then Greyjoy turns like, don't worry about it. This guy is,
he's not going to leave with his head on, right? We get it. He says he's going to let Rob says he's going to let him go, right? At this point, I mean, we all know how this works out and works out well. At this point, it does look like he might be overconfident. Right. There's not really a lot of hints that the show is dropping that he's doing something more mischievous than that.
Or it looks like he's being merciful because no one wants to kill somebody in cold blood.
He's like, well, you don't have to do
it. At least most people don't.
That's what he says, right? He's like, you don't have to do it. Don't worry. Your father would understand. You don't have to kill him.
Yeah.
And someone else can do it, right? So he lets him go, tells him that there's 20,000 Stark men off, you know, whatever he says, Northern men coming to blah, 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 blah. It's like
coming south to see if you really shit gold.
It's a good line. Great John has another great line here is when he says, he asks him if he's touched, which I think I objectively think is funny. And I love what I love actually in a practical sense is I love how this scene really pays off the having earned the respect of Rob earlier in this episode when he lost his couple fingers, right? Mm-hmm. Where he has like called me boy one more time and then he backs down.
Right.
Another small moment that I like is that when I had the closed captioning on when I was watching this. It says that as he leaves the tent, he growls according to the closed captioning. I think that's pretty funny. And it does sound like a little bit like a growl. Yeah.
I'd probably classify it as a grumble, but
no, a closed captioning is always right, Daniel.
Mm.
Now, this is where I would have gotten into my whole problem with the overly obtuse explanations of wherever your army is and all that kind of stuff. But we already talked about that, so we can move past that. Now we cut to a super short shot of Ned in the dungeon for some reason. Just goes, kicks him, goes, hey, fire, and then gone.
Yeah. just a reminder.
Yeah, he's still alive, I guess. That's the idea. I don't know. I don't think you need that scene. For the record,
probably not. I mean, I don't know. I don't
padding it out. They needed a little padding. They needed 30 seconds of padding to really make that 59 minute.
Maybe
mark.
Maybe they wanted to do more with it and then got cut down. Ned is still at this point the headliner.
Yeah, it's true. It's crazy because I was thinking about that he gets Jim Bean. No,
Sean Bean. Bean.
Jim Bean is very different.
Jim Beam is a bourbon.
Anyway. Sean Bean gets top billing all this whole season.
Right.
Right. Tyrion gets top billing like quickly soon. Like he's the headliner taking basically after this season. He right. gets top billing. I think it's interesting because Tyrion's name comes at the end, but he also gets an and Peter Dinklage. The and is actually like specially negotiated
in season one.
He gets all the names and Peter Dinklage. So the and
right.
thing. Or featuring blank
right.
is always something you have to negotiate in your contract.
Right.
So that's good to know. So we're in the throne room. Yeah, Ned's alive. Now we're in the throne room. Sansa arrives. Everyone is staring at her. And we overhear Janice Slint is being knighted, essentially, and being given Harrenhal as his, like...
He's not being knighted, but he's being made a lord.
Right. Okay. But it's similar. Like it's a similar process.
Sure, yeah. It's an official...
Right. And this is the first of many times that Harrenhal will change hands or is just given to people, which I think is pretty funny.
For doing something shady.
Yeah. No one wants it, Dan.
And Harrenhal is a bad omen. Nobody lives there ever.
Is like
No one becomes the lord of it and has good fortune afterwards.
Okay. Who originally had it? Who built it?
Black King Harren.
Okay. Harrenhal.
Makes sense. Yeah. He was the lord of the Iron Islands. Back when they were a superpower, and so that's how far inland they got.
Mm, pretty far.
From the Iron Islands to the God's Eye.
And, it's pretty far. Yeah, they had that whole coast?
They destroyed the River Lords. They took over much of the Westerlands.
They owned half of the continent, basically.
Not quite, but like they made a good push, and then the Stormlord at the time was going to face them, but the day Harrenhal was finished building the largest castle in the realm,
literally the day
the same
done.
Day was the day that Aegon landed in King's Landing, and eventually all three dragons came and burnt Harrenhal to a crisp and melted the stone. Iron Man inside the stone.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's what he's given anyway. And the next thing that happens is, I think, another really great moment on the show. It's not Tywin being appointed king. That's actually the next thing that happens. Tywin gets appointed Hand of the King. But what happens after that is one of the next greatest moments that happened on the show. I think is really cool is when Ser Barristan is basically retired.
Yeah.
And Jaime replaces him as like head of the King's Guard.
Lord Commander of the King's Guard.
And
it's so obvious when you look, like, listen to it, like, all the names of the people that they're appointing are Lannister. Like, Jaime's the Lord Commander. Tywin's the Hand. Janos Slynt, whatever, he's not technically a Lannister, but it's just them surrounding themselves so obviously with a group of Lannister sycophants.
Yeah.
And nobody can do anything about it.
I was going to say, so what Cersei really wants is, she values most is loyalty to her and her family, right?
Well, she values usefulness.
She
can use people.
Right. But
I don't think
she cares about her family in the sense that she cares about herself and her son.
Right. But I don't think that she believes in loyalty. I think she believes in holding power over people.
I think loyalty to her cause is important to
right.
her, I think. In the sense that, like, what's his name? The crazy Meister.
Qyburn.
Qyburn. Like, what power does she hold over Qyburn?
It's not even about necessarily power over him, although obviously she does have power over him, but it's about her. She feels like she's manipulating him. She feels like she's using
him. Yeah, but does he feel it that way? I don't think
that
so.
That doesn't matter.
Yeah. But he's not really being manipulated. That's the truth in that situation.
She thinks that she is making him useful. Like, she is using somebody.
Right.
She's
like,
not,
if it wasn't
she's
for
not
me,
friends
be,
with him.
You would be just like, you'd be nothing, basically.
Right.
Anyway, so what I was wondering here is, like, what's the reason for getting rid of Barristan? Like, what is she just wants someone, she just wants Jaime close by all the time?
Consolidation of power. Barristan, I don't know if he would ever stand up to her necessarily, but he was a man of honor.
No, he was pissed off. No, because of course he wouldn't, because he calls Jaime out for stabbing the king in the first place,
right?
He's not the type of guy to be like, well, he's crazy or this king is illegitimate, whatever.
But
from my
did.
Point of view, what?
But he did. He was around for the duration of the Mad King's regency.
Right, that's what I'm saying. And he was standing around the whole time. He didn't.
He didn't do anything.
Aiding and abetting, right?
I think were the stuff to come out about Joffrey's parentage, that may have been the straw that broke the camel's back.
Do you think he would have been like, fine.
Not the horse that broke the camel's back?
No,
that's a reference.
Stag, damn.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
It was a stag. And it's a good line, and I'll stand by it for the end of days, Daniel. They say in this scene, until the end of time.
Uh-huh.
Okay? The end of time.
Regardless, the point of getting rid of Ser Barristan is as much about getting rid of the old blood, the old guard, someone who would probably stand up to them, as it is about placing people on their side in a position of power.
Yes. I like that they're like, don't worry, though. We'll give you a nice keep to hang out by the ocean, you know? Nice retirement. And he's like, no, a hall to die in, men to bury me. And he's just all very, like, he's the classic knight of any story. Like, you think of, like, knights in shining armor, that is Ser Barristan. I think he kind of embodies that archetype.
He definitely tries to, or he definitely is meant to read that way.
Right. I am a knight. I shall die a knight. And then he, like, takes off his gloves and his helmet, and he, like, throws them on the ground. And then Littlefinger gets that little dig out at him. I hated that line. I was so pissed.
I can tell you're mad about it.
A naked knight, apparently. That's how it sounded like when he said it. Ugh. Little shithead. Anyway, I like Ser Barristan.
Everybody does. Yeah. What's not to like?
And what I'm kind of talking about here, beating around the bush, is that this is really the first moment, like the first act of as like Queen Regent that Cersei has. And it's like you said, it's just so transparent that, you know, what her goals are and what's important to her. And she doesn't care about honor or tradition or, you know, the right thing to do. That's not important to her at all, right? So just make whatever decisions are best for her, always, right? And then Sansa makes like a plea for mercy to Joffrey for her father. And this is one of those weird moments where Joffrey's like, if he had been raised slightly different, he might have turned out to have been okay, like a decent enough person. No, it.
No, you're forgetting again. Much like earlier, this is all practiced. He was told what to do. Yeah, 100%.
Is that made clear at any point, or are you just presuming?
It's made clear because later on in the next episode, when the shoe drops,
yeah,
Cersei's surprised. Everything up until that point was planned.
Oh, right, because
Joffrey
was
coached. Joffrey was coached to act this way, to act like a, especially in front of all those people in King's Landing, in front of the court.
The ladies, yeah,
yeah.
I see.
Changes
my reading of the scene.
Yeah, every single time you see him being nice to Sansa, it's because he was told it would look good.
Right. It turns out he's just a terrible person.
Yeah, no, he's unforgivable.
Well, I take everything I said back. Everything, but actually, no, that's not true. Only the times I messed up Rob and John, and also Winterfell and Castle Black. Right. Just those things I take back. anyway, so that's what happens. I think Sansa actually makes a pretty good argument about Ned not being himself due to the milk of the poppy thing. Like that's a reasonable thing to say. Like he does not know what he's doing. He's all high, right?
Mm-hmm.
On heroin, essentially, right?
Yeah, more or less.
Opium. So yeah. So I thought that was pretty good. I was like one of the few times I was like, oh, okay, that's nice. Decent enough argument. But like you said, it doesn't really matter. And Joffrey says that he has to confess to his crimes and declare Joffrey king, and only then will he receive mercy. Sansa says he will, and then we cut to black.
Which is, I think, as much as this was a really busy, like intense episode,
it's cool
kind of
an
anti, like, I don't know. I think out of all the episodes, each other episode this season had a cooler ending than that.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's probably true. I just think that it's, when considering how next episode ends,
exactly.
I think it's so a cool,
when you understand the gravity of that situation, it makes more sense in context. But just in terms of watching it, it's just a little girl.
You know, if they just changed it around a bit and just end on that super short shot of Ned.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Just move that scene back one, and it's basically everything's the same, right?
Right.
Better. All right, so overall thoughts. I already said my favorite scene was that scene in Winterfell
right.
with all the Bannermen. I would have liked... Here's the thing, another thing I would have liked this scene. More of the other Bannermen get a little screen time.
Right.
You know? It's like they're all just kind of sitting around. Like, presumably, what's his name is probably there.
Bolton.
Bolton. Lord Bolton's probably there, right?
Right.
But we don't see him.
He's not even at the table for some reason. He should be.
Yeah.
None of the other Bannermen get a line. There's some cool ones there. Like, obviously, Glover is mentioned, and he kind of reacts to the Great John. Mage Mormont is there, the only female at the table.
Mage.
Yeah. So, and
is she, like, filling in? No, I guess.
No, she's the...
What happens to her? Oh, yeah, she's killed. That makes
eventually
sense.
Eventually, she's killed. Yeah.
I know when it happens, too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Roose Bolton should have been there. He just wasn't cast at that point.
Yeah, it's true.
I think one of the other people along at the table, maybe like sitting in his place, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean that's probably what they were probably like. Well, we know that some of these characters are going to be important, but we don't have them cast properly yet. So
because when Rob does his diversion, Roose Bolton is who he puts in charge of the army. That's the diversion.
Right.
That's how they get separated. That's how Roose can make his power plays.
Right. Bad call. Bad call.
Yeah, never trust a Bolton. Never trust somebody whose sigil is them flaying a human being. Everyone else is like...
And by the way, they live in a swamp. So, of course, they're going to be grumpy.
Well, no, they don't live in a swamp.
They do.
Who?
We've seen that castle. It's in a swamp.
The Dreadfort. Yeah. Well, it's wooded.
In the show, man, it's in a swamp. It's in the show. I'm just saying from the show perspective. It's in the middle of this... swamp. It's a very cool establishing shot. We've seen it a million times.
The Reeds live in a swamp.
No, Dan.
The Mo'Kaelin is a swamp. The Dreadfort is in a forest.
It's not. Not in the show.
When Ramsay Bolton is hunting like those girls with the dogs, it's a forest.
It's nearby.
Anyways.
There's a nearby forest. That's
anyways,
fine.
Point is, everyone else in the show has like a bird or a wolf or a lion as a sigil, and theirs is a person being skinned alive. They're bad people.
Who started that whole, like, who decided that was going to be their sigil, you know? Like, how many of...
That's something that they were proud of. That's something that they were known for.
Yeah. For being brutal, apparently. And that's cool.
The Tyrells have a flower.
That's true. Well, they get shit for that, though, all the time.
And understandably so, but, like, everyone else is everywhere in between. Like, there's just, like, you could be a rooster if you wanted, but...
All right, so here's my overall thoughts. All right. I think this is generally a pretty strong episode. Despite how overly busy it is, I think it is overly busy. It bounces around too much.
Sure.
The second shot, like that second shot of Ned, is just like a prime example of that. There's just no reason for that.
Well, it's
there's
probably
no reason for that.
You're
shot.
Right, but it's probably the only useless cut in the show. In this episode,
I would say that yeah, no, you're right. Every scene is important, but I don't know if they all need to be in this episode. If that makes sense, is it? You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
So, I think that's you know, it's a nit to pick a little bit. It's a large one, a large nit. I like how it starts, like I said, in media res, kind of right picking up right after the events of last week's episode. I like that we deal with the fallout of that of that event, because it's a big shocker. That's right. Like a mini episode 9 event that we got in episode 7. So we deal with the fallout of that a lot in this episode, and I think that's really interesting because that's something we normally only see in episode 10 of a season, and then by the time we get to the next season, all the stuff has already kind of moved on. We're on to something else,
right?
It also does a lot of work building up the whole White Walker situation, like I talked about. More work than we get from the show for a long time, and I think that's important. I think that's well done here. Again, as I mentioned, I like the War Council stuff, but I thought it could have been handled better. Ultimately, I still feel like this is a very strong episode, and all the good of it outweighs the bad. But I think there's a few few inconsistencies that I'm not a huge fan of.
Yeah, it certainly jumps around a lot, and in terms of pace as well, you'll go from scenes where shit's going down in King's Landing to a bit of a slower pace in the North or Castle Black.
They cut from, you know what I mean? From like murders to carrying a dead body around.
Exactly. So it's a bit of up and down in that sense. I remember like looking back, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes that I was in when I first watched it. I remember thinking this was one of my favorite episodes of the season. Obviously, it's well written. George R. R. Martin.
I think
Mastermind.
Last episode's way better.
I don't know. It's been months since I watched last episode, so it's hard to keep track of how I felt about it. But no, I really did love this episode. In terms of a favorite scene, I don't know. The Sirio, his swan song, you can't
tell the god of death.
You can't, you know, overlook that. I think my favorite interaction in this episode, though, is Rob and Maester Luwin when he says, "I'm going to call the banners." And
all
he just,
of them.
He gives him that knowing look. Are you sure? And he's all like, "Yeah, we're pulling the trigger." Yeah. So.
That is a cool scene. That's a good pick. And it gives Theon some stuff to do, which I talked about. Okay. I think we can wrap it up there, unless you have any other thoughts on the episode.
That's probably good, I think.
Okay. So follow us on Twitter at Tower Babblecast. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/TowerBabblecast. TowerBabble.ca for everything we do. But yeah, the best place to keep up to date with any updates about the show is on Twitter. That's your best bet. We are back. What's the next week's episode? Do you know?
Baylor.
I should have known that. I know.
Everybody in the world knows that.
Yeah. I should know that. Anyways, that's the one that we'll be doing next. Episode 9. Season 1, episode 9. So join us for that. And we'll talk to you then.
See you.
This week's Game of Thrones theme is a piano cover by Tony Ann. That's Tony Ann. And you can find his work on YouTube.